The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
We look at the same things, but we very often see them through totally different eyes. And this is actually part of the challenge of sharing, you know, a learning experience in general, particularly sharing a learning experience from the perspective of being in the old city, right? And particularly this discussion. It would be fair to assume on the topic of prayer, because we're going to talk a little bit this week about the nature of tefillah of prayer, the structure of prayer, tefillah, how the siddur, the prayer book, works, and specifically what the purpose is, what we're trying to attempt, what we're trying to get out of prayer, right? And we're going to get pretty deep into this topic. And of course, it makes sense that we're going to start with the purpose and the nature of tefillah in general. Is anybody out there? What exactly am I doing? Am I talking to the wall? Or is there somebody listening, right? But in order to do this, we got to take 5 minutes to sort of clear the air a little bit. And then what I want to do is I want to share with you a text. And we could have picked any number, any variety of texts. I just chose one that I think most of you are less familiar with, so that there'll be something to grapple with. And we're actually going to take a few minutes and study this instead of in a frontal lecture mode. I want to turn this more into a Beit Midrash, a house of study, do a little chavruta. Chavruta is a study partnership. We'll talk about that in a minute. And we'll see where we get to. So first of all, by way of questions, right? If you could pick the top questions when associating with the question of prayer, of tefillah, what would they be? Okay? Not long discourses, please. Just, this is not a rhetorical question. Just the basic questions of prayer. Yeah. What's the point of prayer? Okay? If God knows what is going to happen in the world, right? If God's got it all planned out. So then what exactly is it I'm trying to accomplish? Yeah? Right? Why do I have to say the same thing every day? Why do I have to say the same thing this afternoon that I said this morning? Hello? Doesn't God know? Right? You know? You would think there's a short recall issue here. Why do the rabbis seem to get so carried away? You know? When I was a kid, we used to have this thing, right? Rub-a-dub-dub, thanks for the grub, yay God, done. I mean, we could have this intense experience just around that sentence. But we got to go on and on and on, right? We're going to talk about blessings also, yes.
Is there more or less value in that versus I went for the wall and then talk about
God? Okay, all right, okay. It's interesting, by the way, we're going to get into a discussion about that tomorrow when we talk about the Siddur, the prayer book, the history of it, you know, et cetera, that we actually make some common mistakes about when to use Hebrew and not to use Hebrew, yeah?
Is it really making a difference?
Ooh.
What?
Is it really making a difference? You know, you have, this is an important point, you have different types of tefillah, of prayer experiences. Sometimes you have a prayer experience and you really walk away feeling, wow, that really worked. And then later you start to wonder whether it worked or it just happened, you know, to be. I'll give you just a good example by way of just introduction. Because I actually want you, while we're having this discussion, I want you to think about whether you've ever had a tefillah experience, okay? Prayer experience that you were so focused that you knew exactly what you were praying for and that you could empirically measure. I mean, in the business world, they'll tell you that success is about accountability. And part of accountability is about being able to measure whether you succeeded or not. And every experiment, every prototype in the world has to fit into that pattern. Can you measure its success, right? One could make a case for saying that that's the challenge with the Middle East peace process, right? So sometimes you can actually measure it, and sometimes you can't. You know, part of the challenge is, what is it I'm trying to connect to? And part of the challenge is, what if I don't feel connected, not before, not during, and not after? I mean, does that mean that I've failed? I mean, there are moments in life where you absolutely feel the strength or the power of tefillah, of prayer, right? I'll give you a good example. I was, there's a rule at Israelite, you cannot have a day at Israelite without an army story, so I apologize. But, so I was, we were, we'll get it out of the way early, we'll be done with it, right? We were, this is about 3 months after I became an officer, and there was a village, which was in the Shuf Mountains, It was causing a lot of problems in Lebanon, causing a lot of problems. And there were some terrorist cells there. So the battalion commander decided, right, you know, enough is enough. And we're gonna clean out this village. Right? And this was actually the first time for me personally where I was actually an experience where we had time to think about it. All the other experiences I ever had, you know, we were out, whatever, something happened. You got ambushed, you got fired at, you know, whatever it is. This is the first time, you know, they sit down on a Monday night and they say, well, Wednesday we're going to be taking this village, so we're going to plan it for the next day and a half. Now, on the one hand, it's great to go into a mission where you're organized and you're prepared and you've planned it and you've practiced it and you've studied the map by heart. On the other hand, it means that for 36 hours, you know, you've got all this, you know, acid and digestion working, right? And you would see, especially like the officers, every once in a while somebody go behind a shack and just, you know, right, from the pressure. Anyway, it's a very complicated thing because this village sat at the top of a mountain road, right, in the Shuf Mountains, and there was really only one access point. And the only way to safeguard the two companies that were moving up this mountain pass to enter this village without sort of turning it into a, you know, an enemy ambush was to create a support team that would be on top of a ridge that was overlooking this village. So basically what happened was I was supposed to take this company of tanks, and we were going to take a totally different route, and we were going to arrive at this ridge, and this ridge was overlooking this village, and that way we would be able to provide fire support, cover. I think part of it was also psychological. If you wake up and you see that the Israeli army is entering the village, and then you look up and you see that there's a whole company of tanks on the ridge, so it kind of, you know, demotivates you from doing anything dumb, right? Now the problem with this was that you had to arrive at this cover position at this ridge not too early, not too late. If you got there too early, people would notice a company of tanks sitting on the ridge, and they'd know something was up. And if you got there too late, well, duh, right? That wouldn't work too well either. So that was complicated, because you had to figure out, so, you know, there's a whole system, you would let them know by radio where you were, whatever. So I have this fear, personally, this was my biggest fear when I was in the Army, was actually not combat, bullets, whatever. That stuff is all in the hands of God anyway, it was getting lost. I had this tremendous fear that one day, I would just get my whole company lost. You know, navigating, wouldn't read the map right, something, you know, we're out somewhere and I don't know where I am, there's a whole company following me and I don't know what to do. So I was fanatic about studying the map. And I would memorize the map and do it again and again until I recognized it in my sleep, right? So that's what I did. I memorized the map and, you know, we're heading up this mountain pass and we're doing everything we're supposed to do. And we get to like a crossroads and this is like the first of three crossroads and then you get to another crossroad, right? Get to the third crossroad, make a right, supposed to go about a kilometer and I'm going to hit this ridge that overlooks this village. So I get to this third crossroads and we bear right, right? And traveling kilometer, 2 kilometers, 3 kilometers, and all of a sudden we get to another crossroads. That's a problem, right? And now we stop at the crossroads. You have to understand, it's not just like you're in a car on vacation and your wife is saying, no. This is like a company of tanks here in Lebanon. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. Battalion commander, you know, is on the radio waiting for you to tell him you're there. And my loader, because, you know, there's two guys sticking out of the tank. There's the loader and whatever. So my loader, Avi, you know, he's used to what's going on. So he's never really seen me pause, you know. So I'm like pausing and kind of looking at both roads. So he looks at me and goes, Korpseda, you know, is everything okay? Oh, yeah, you know, everything's okay. You don't really want to tell your crew. Oh, no, we're lost. You know, that's not a good way to go. So I'm looking at this crossroads and I'm thinking, okay, did the first right, did the second left, did the third right, did the thing, went through and realized exactly what the map said. This crossroads isn't supposed to be here. Of course, nobody told me to the crossroads, right? So thinking minutes, I pull out my map. Now Avi's getting nervous. Why is he pulling out his map? He never saw me pull out my map before because I was, you know, phobic about this. So I'm looking at the map and I'm going through this. Now we get a call from the battalion commander. You know? Zemel Zemel Kan Kodkod, you know, this is the commanding officer. Nu? Haim Angia, are you in position, right? So, you know, Rut Tamten, you know, hang on just a second. Now you don't tell a battalion commander just a second when there's a whole mission and everybody's ready to go. So my loader's now getting very nervous and I don't know what to do. So what do you do? What do you do? You're in the middle of Lebanon. You've got a crossroads. You can go right, you can go left. What do you do? There's no announced directions, no gas station. You pray. There ain't nothing else to do, right? So this is what I call, you know, the desperate prayer. Okay? It usually starts with the words, would you give me a break? Right? Listen, God, you know, I've been doing everything. Now, I'm not the kind of guy who gets up, you know, in the middle and says, hallelujah. It's just not my speed, you know? A little more laid back. Doing everything you asked me to do. I came to Israel. I'm in the army. Never asked for anything. Give me a break! I need something here because I don't know which way to go. You know, and like, hello, 7 isn't going to work today, right? I promise you. I promise you this happened. I wonder about this sometimes. out of nowhere, this huge white bird flies out of nowhere and lands in the right crosswalk and sits there looking at me. Middle of the road, 15 feet from the thing. And I'm looking at this bird. I'm thinking like, nah. And the bird's looking at me. And I'm looking at this bird. And Avi, my loader's looking at me. Now he's really wondering what's going on, right? I figure like, okay, you know, because that's the biggest problem. Sometimes we ask, and we actually get the answer, but we're too dumb to realize it. So I figure if God's sending the... I later find out that these are actually called African storks, also called Polish storks. And they're actually very unique because their migration route goes over Israel. And what's unique about them is that they have two nests, one in Africa and one in Europe, usually in Poland. And they actually fly thousands of miles every year, and they return to the exact same nest. They've done homing, you know, scientific experiments. But of course, I didn't know at the time. Not that it makes a difference. Anyway, I got nothing to lose, so I take the right turn, and we go about, you know, 1,000 yards, whatever. And sure enough, we come to the, you know, ridge, and we're overlooking the village, and I give the happy report. To this day, none of my men know exactly what happened, right? Avi kind of, what was that thing with the bird? Oh, no, it's just I was fascinated. You know, I want to make sure I'm going the right way, right? So sometimes you feel the tefillah works. But I'm very challenged by that. Because what does that mean? What does that mean? Tefillah, prayer, is the question you have? You have to ask a question and you get an answer? I mean, is that what prayer is? Is it a shopping list? Do we have a list of things we ask for? And by the way, if that's true, which certainly it seemed to me that afternoon, well then, what about all the people who ask for things and don't get them? Is there some recipe we're missing? Are we supposed to be doing something that we're just not doing right? What's the point? So with that in mind, let's just summarize what the questions are. What is it I'm trying to accomplish? Who is it that I'm praying to? What is prayer? Why do I have to ask God for anything, since God knows everything I'm thinking anyway and has preordained and planned it, right? I mean, this is all part of God's game anyway, right? We may even get into a discussion about what is God, right? Why do I say these things every day? Why not just when I need them, which is an interesting debate in the Talmud? Why do I say them 3 times a day? And why do I actually have a specific recipe for saying them? And those are the topics we're going to get into this week, and we're going to get started this morning. But before we do that, what I want to do is I want to share with you a text. Okay, that is a very interesting text, and I'll give you just by way of introduction. This is from the Talmud in Shabbat. It got photostated, so you're missing the Hebrew side of the page number. It's Daf Pei Tet, the 89th folio of the Tractate of Shabbat, Masechet Shabbat. And just by way of introduction, so we go into this in the same place, in the same space, there are actually 2 parts to the Torah, and there are 2 parts to one of those parts of the Torah. The 2 parts to the Torah, the thing that we call Torah, are the written tradition and the oral tradition. Just so we're all on the same page. Written tradition is very simple to understand, right? We have this book, we call it the 5 books of Moses, Chamisha Chumshei Torah, right? And it's basically a written recipe. And probably the biggest question that we all struggle with, or some people struggle with, is, you know, what the source of this book is. Is this a divinely written, divinely inspired, however you want to choose to look at it? Or is this some brilliant concoction of a group of individuals, right? I think everything changes depending on how you look at this book. And you need to know if we're going to study together that in my opinion, you know, this is definitely a divine book. But I don't want anybody here who's just walked in to think that you need to think that. That's your business. It took me a long time to struggle with that question. I think it's a question worth struggling with, right? And I get very nervous somebody walks into a class and 60 seconds later, you know, hallelujah, the book's divine, right? You got to struggle with this. It's a good question. I would urge you, for the course of the week, to read it as though it's a divine book, just so we're on the same page, and see what that does for the way you study it, but by no means accept it if it's not your speed. Having said that, one thing is very clear. Whatever your opinion on this book, whether you think that the Torah is divine or not, clearly the written law, which is a tradition that we have going way back, anybody you ask, was not enough to make this book make sense. There are all sorts of pieces that are missing in this written law, right? So there is also an oral tradition. By way of explanation, what I mean by that is that there are all sorts of pieces here that make no sense. For example, the Torah tells me, ukshatam la'ot al yadecha, you should tie them for a sign on your hands. Va'ilu totafot b'nenecha, there'll be a totafah between your eyes. And we know that this is talking about tefillin. And anywhere in the world that you go, you will see people putting on tefillin in the morning, and they put them on the same way, and the tefillin are the same color. It doesn't say anywhere in this book, those are the only two verses that speak about tefillin. It doesn't tell you what color they are, it doesn't tell you what they look like, it doesn't even tell you that they're supposed to be up here and not here. And yet any Jew anywhere in the world that you find wears tefillin the same way. In fact, one of the reasons why a great number of Torah scholars believed that Ethiopian Jewry actually were a part of traditional Judaism dating back 2,500 years was because they separated from the mainstream Jewish community for at least 2,300 years, had exactly the same tefillin we have. They're black, they're boxes, they had the same parchments inside. There was a difference in the way they tied it, but other than that, same tefillin. Now what that means, since that's not written in the written book, since everybody has the same tefillin, is that at whatever point we got this book, it had to come with some set of instructions. Because if the instructions didn't come whenever this was given, then we would have developed different traditions. Right? In fact, it always amazes me, all the programs we've ever done in Israel, nobody's ever walked in here and said, you know, this tefillin thing, black, whew, maybe we could try like psychedelic orange, you know? Nobody's ever done that. And don't get any ideas, because really don't want to start a new tradition here. But given that that's the case, so there's an oral tradition. Now, what people don't know, or don't usually explore, is that the oral tradition has two pieces. And there's a value to this tradition being oral, and we'll talk about that during the week. The oral tradition also has two pieces. One is called halakha, and one is called agada. Now, halakha is very easy to explain. Halakha comes from the root lalechet, to go, to journey. Okay? We're on a journey. And this is the recipe that accompanies us in the journey. And you could call halakha, known in certain circles as halakha, right? The who, what, where, and how of Judaism. In other words, if the Torah tells me, you know, lo tavaru esh b'chol moshevotichem, don't light a fire, and the oral tradition tells me, well, what does that mean, to light a fire? Well, that also means that you don't cook on Shabbat. Well, what does cooking mean? What if I just take a piece of salami and I'm playing frisbee and it lands on the hot plate for a second? Is that cooking, right? Right, is that cooking, right? How long does it have to be there to cook? What about if you didn't intend for it to be there to cook? And all sorts of questions like that. If I want to make a cup of tea on Shabbat, am I cooking the tea leaves? Right? And so on and so forth. Right? So all the who, what, where, and how, that's halacha. The agadah, however, the agadah is all about the why and the what for. The philosophy, the theology. All the theological questions, every philosophical underpinning of Judaism that you could ever think of, ever ask, or ever wonder, is in the oral tradition. It's interesting, by the way, that in the Talmud, which is more or less the collection of the entire oral tradition written down, right? That the Talmud is probably about 90 to 95% halacha, and about 5 to 10% agada. Agada are what you might mistakenly call the stories. Okay? They're the stories. When you're studying the Talmud, and you're learning, I don't know, Masechet Brachot, the first tractate of the Talmud, and it's called Brachot Blessings, and the whole discussion's in there about when I pray in the evening, and when I pray in the morning, and how often, you know, what words do I have to say, and what words do I not say, and what if I'm on a journey on a donkey, do I stop the prayer, do I keep journeying, and all the who, what, where, how prayers, right? The holy prayer for the bathroom, which doesn't mean that you pray about the welfare of the bathroom, but when you come out of the bathroom, you have a prayer, right? So that's the who, what, where, how. So all of a sudden you'll be studying Brachot and you'll read all these weird stories. You know? If you were walking on a road to Jerusalem and Rabbi Meir was on his way to Jerusalem and he stopped to pray and he walked into a ruin and Elijah the prophet came to wait for him and they got into this whole discussion and you're kind of wondering, what is that? That's Agadah. Now the reason I bring this up is because we're about to study an Agadah, and I want you to understand that there's an interesting debate about this Agadah. Now, in order to understand the debate about Agadah, so that we can understand this story, and you'll have the context to attack it in about 2 minutes, just one more word of introduction. Why did we write down the oral tradition? And this, by the way, is going to apply to the Siddur as well. The Siddur, the prayer book, a large part of the Siddur was not part of the written Torah. There are parts of it, the Shema, for example, is part of the written Torah, but there are whole sections. For example, if you, the Shemona Esrei, the 18, 19 benediction prayer that Rabbi Aaron introduced and was talking about yesterday, concludes with a prayer called the Elokai Netzor, right? Which we can talk about during lunch one day. That's part of the oral tradition. You find that in the Talmud. It was an oral tradition, and there's a value to having an oral tradition. And it's supposed to be oral. As a matter of fact, technically speaking, we weren't supposed to write it down. And there are good reasons for that. Things that come orally bring with them the prospect of relationships. The fact that we're relating to a book as a teacher instead of having a teacher in our lives is a tremendous loss. You could make a case for saying it's one of the greatest things that we're missing today in the Jewish world. People don't have a Rebbe. People don't have a teacher that they're close with, that they can relate to. But if the entire oral tradition could only be received orally, you would inevitably have to develop a relationship with your teacher. And we lost that. There's a flexibility that comes with the oral tradition. The fact that a tradition is oral, and that you can discuss it and explore it, it's not written down. If you ever want to really understand this, ask a lawyer to do you a favor. If he's a good guy, he'll do whatever you want. As soon as you ask him to write it down, he goes into lawyer mode. Because when you write something down, you're committing to it in a different way. It becomes unbending. So why did they write this down? Well, they actually wrote this down because of things that were happening here in Israel. We're going to actually talk about this a little this afternoon when we go on our walking tour around the Old City. But basically, some 1900 years ago after the Bar Kokhba Rebellion, in the year 135 CE, the Romans finally realized that after not one but two revolts in less than 70 years, they had to do something to quash this Jewish spirit of independence. They figured out that the secret to Jewish independence, Jewish continuity, Jewish dreams of return to whatever we wanted to return to, were in these books. They were in our Torah. So they decided to destroy every last vestige of our spiritual path, of our tradition, of our heritage. And one of the things that they started to do was to kill off the rabbis. Rabbis back then weren't like rabbis today. You know, today you do a rabbinical degree, 3 years, 4 years, 1 year, you can get your, 90-day wonder, $59.99, rabbinic certification, which, by the way, I'm not laughing about because maybe you get more rabbis, that's another discussion. But back then, to be a rabbi meant that you received the okay, the go-ahead, the ordination from someone who had received the ordination from someone who had received the ordination, all the way back to Moshe at Sinai. And a person didn't give out those types of ordinations lightly. He studied with you until he felt that you knew all the rules of exegesis, all the rules of study, the sum total of the oral tradition. I mean, someone, for example, like Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was the greatest scholar of his day when the temple was destroyed, had only 5 students. Because it was a lifetime experience. And that's how you became a rabbi. There are great Torah scholars in the Talmud who don't have the title rabbi because they didn't manage to get this type of rabbinic certification, so the Romans started killing off the rabbis. At which point, a great rabbi by the name of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, decided, we have to put this down on paper or we're going to lose it forever. Like grandma's recipe, right? And he started to write down. Now how he did this is a discussion for lunchtime if you want. The totality of the oral tradition, that was called the Mishnah. And he didn't really want to write down all the discussions because he wanted to keep the dialogue alive, but he wrote down sort of the basic ideas so that we would have a format with which to be sure that we wouldn't forget the discussions. Over time, over the next few hundred years, we started to even forget the discussions, and then they wrote down more, and that was called the Gemara. And the sum totality of that is the Talmud. Right? 20 different tractates that sit in these books, okay? And basically the Talmud, which was concluded, the Babylonian Talmud, around the year 500 CE, by two men, Ravina and Ravashi, contains the totality of the oral tradition. By the way, it is the last time a Jewish book was accepted in its totality by the entire Jewish people. We haven't had that since. Even Maimonides, haven't had that since. Pardon? That's true. That's true. Endless Light. That's true. But that's a different level, right? Right. But in some ways what that means is that this book, what we call the Talmud, the Gemara, has basically, this is Maimonides' opinion, has taken the place of that biblical rabbinic ordination. It has become our Rebbe. Which is why if you want to rule on a question on halakha, you need to at least know what the Talmud says, because that's our Rebbe. And in the Talmud, we have both these sections. And here we get to the point. When Rebbe decides that we have, Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, Judah the Prince, decides that we have to write this stuff down because we're losing it, writing down the halakha is no problem. You just write it down. Right? How many cups do you need at the Seder? How much is supposed to be in each cup of wine? How big is a piece of matzah in order for you to fulfill the mitzvah of eating matzah? You write it down. And some of it comes in the form of discussions, and some of it comes in the form of questions and answers or whatever. But how do you write down Agadah? How do you write down the theological underpinnings of why we're here? Of how you develop a relationship with God? Of the purpose of prayer? Of the meaning of mitzvot? Of how to become a better human being? How do you write that down? In fact, it's very dangerous to write that down, because if you write that down in a written, composite, empirical, closed format, then when someone else comes along hundreds of years hence, and maybe isn't coming at it from quite the right perspective, or isn't prepared for it, he can do with it whatever he wants, and very often distort it and abuse it. That's a very dangerous thing. So that's why they wrote down much of the Agadah, the philosophy, the theology, etc., in stories. Because a story is a harmless thing. If you're ready for it, if you know that there's a recipe to understanding these stories, if you come at it from a certain context, then you'll arrive at the theological underpinnings of Judaism. And if you're not ready for it, and you don't get that it's a recipe, then you've read an interesting story. Which leads me to the last question before I'm going to give you this text. So these stories, did they really happen? Do I have to believe that they happened? Do I have to believe, for example, there's an Agada that says that, you know, that asks the question of why Mount Sinai was chosen as the mountain on which the Torah was given? It's an interesting question. So in the middle of the Gemara somewhere in Shabbat, I think, in Sanhedrin, why was the Torah given on Sinai? And so the Gemara tells a story. It says, well, you know, all the mountains came before God, and they wanted the Torah given on them. And this mountain said this, you know, Mount Kilimanjaro said, choose me because I've got this incredible ice cap. And Mount Everest said, choose me because I'm the biggest. You know, and the Rocky Mountains said, choose me because we love the Yankees. You know, whatever it might be, right? And all these mountains come before God except for little Mount Sinai. And little Mount Sinai is standing on the side, and God says, what about you? And Mount Sinai says, me? Listen, I'm the littlest mountain. I don't even have what to say. And so God says, okay, so I'm going to give the Torah on you. So I had a brother-in-law who went to religious school, yeshiva, way back when. And they had a different attitude to Agadata. And so he remembers as a boy, he was 5 or 6 years old, they were studying the story. So he asked the Rebbe, he said, did mountains talk? Could mountains talk? It's a good question, five-year-old. So the Rebbe said, well, back then mountains could talk. I remember hearing this, and I'm like, okay. Now that's an interesting question. Do I have to believe that those stories occurred? There's a big debate about this. And the reason I'm sharing this with you is twofold. One is so that you understand the context that we're about to get into, and the other is because you need to know where I'm coming from so that we can, you know, communicate. You need to know what page I'm on. Big debate. I would say that the overwhelming majority of rabbinic opinions are actually that you do not have to believe that these stories happen. The Vilna Gaon, the Rashbam, who was one of the grandchildren of Rashi, the Ramchal of Moshe Chaim Lutzato, whatever. We can get into all the names some other time. There are, however, some opinions that say, no, these traditions actually occurred. Most notable amongst them is the Baal HaTanya, and that's why Lubavitch has a very different approach to Agadita. So I want you to understand, we're not going to get into this discussion, both of these opinions are valid. But, you know, in general in life, when there are different opinions and both are valid, right, and yet you have to choose one, so very often you choose what you connect to. So where I'm coming from, right, the issue for me is not whether these occurred. I don't doubt that some of these did occur. I also personally don't doubt that some of these didn't occur. It's totally irrelevant to me. Because the purpose of these stories is not whether they happened. This is not a book of history. I don't need to know that Alexander the Great, right, showed up at Jerusalem and Shimon HaTzadik, Simon the Just, came out and they had this whole dialogue. The issue for me is what the message is. What is the Talmud trying to teach me? There's a very important message here. Receiving Torah in your life comes from a sense of humility. And what does that mean? What does it mean that the littlest mountain is where the Torah was given? What does it mean that that mountain has disappeared? We don't know where it is. We don't care about the place where Torah was given. We gave it back in a peace agreement and nobody even uttered a peep about it. Because it's not the mountain in Judaism that's important. This one is. And what does that mean? And so that's where I'm coming to this Gemara from. Okay? So don't get stuck on, wait a second, did this really happen? Because that's just not the issue. The real question is, what is the message of this story? And how does it relate to our questions of tefillah? So I'm going to give you a text, alright? Nati, do me a favor here. We're going to do an experiment called the Chavruta experiment. We're going to turn the lecture hall into a study hall, right? The way a Chavruta works, Chavruta is the way Jews have been studying for the last 2,000 years, maybe 3,000 years, okay? And that is that we don't just listen, we experience, we struggle. So you have to pick at least one partner. You can sit in larger groups of 3 or 4, it doesn't matter to me. But nobody should be studying this on your own. Right? And there's a way to study Bechavruta. The way to study Bechavruta, right? First you read through a text. The text that you're looking at, okay, I actually marked in both the English and the Hebrew. There are two stories, okay, of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, alright, on folio 89a, Pei Tera Mar Aleph. You can see them in the Hebrew Aramaic on this side, and you can see them in the English on this side. You can choose either or both. And the way to study in a text, this is now my opinion, first you read through the text. Make sure you know what the story is. Then go back and study the text. Now, what is the most important component for study? What's the most important thing that you have to do when you study? Ask questions. Okay? Not comprehension, not, you know, intuition. Just what bothers you. And that's what I want to know. I want to know what the questions are. And then we'll talk about what you think this story means and what we get out of it. Okay? Any questions before we go on? I saw a couple questions. Yes? Okay, let me make this clear again. Good question. You know what? While you're studying, I'm going to write this on the board. There is first the Mishnah. The Mishnah was the first collection of text, okay, that was, sort of the attempt to write down the oral tradition. Okay, that's the Mishnah. And that was completed around the year 200 CE, right? Then you have, there are other sections we didn't talk about, the Braita, the Tosefta. Then you have the Gemara. The Gemara was simply a later period, an expanded discussion on each Mishnah. Okay, the Talmud is actually a word that became used much later, and it really refers to the collection of Mishnah and Gemara. Now, just realize, and then we're going to get into study, when you speak to people, and people talk in vernacular, you're talking to someone who's in yeshiva or whatever, they don't always get these terms technically exactly right. They'll say, what does the Gemara say? But they'll really be referring to a Mishnah. You know? It's written in the Talmud, but they're really quoting a Gemara, right? And that's because, you know, we just use these words interchangeably. But if you don't know technically what they are, that's what they are, yeah.
What year was the Gemara?
The Gemara, there are two Gemaras actually. There's a Jerusalem Talmud and a Babylonian Talmud. The Jerusalem Talmud was completed around the year 300 in Israel. Actually, not in Jerusalem. It was called Jerusalem out of respect to Yerushalayim. It was completed pretty much in Tzipori around the year 300 CE by Rav Yochanan, more or less. And the Babylonian Talmud, which had 200 extra years to be edited, to be considered, you know, to be organized, was completed around the year 500. By two rabbis, Ravina and Ravashi, it was their life's work. And they completed the Talmud, right, the Gemara. And we actually rule according to the Babylonian Talmud whenever there's a discrepancy because it was edited much later and therefore it's more accurate.
So that was 500 CE.
Yes, that's actually the only instance where we choose a later text over an earlier text.
And
the only instance.
Rashi and who else?
No, Rashi's a whole other discussion. Rashi's a... Ravina and Rav Ashi. The majority of the Jews, the overwhelming majority of the Jewish people, in fact, some suggest all of the Jewish people, were in Babylon, in Bavel. Right, there's a... Right, that was the last book. In fact, that was not a simple thing. There was a period that after... There are historical periods that refer to these texts. For example, the period of the Mishnah was known as the Tanaim. Tanaim, those were the names of the rabbis who wrote and taught in the Mishnah. Tanaim. Then the period of the Gemara, right, was actually the Amoraim. They were the rabbis who were whatever. And that's actually an important detail that we're not going to get to now, but just for your knowledge. Sometimes, by the way, don't get stuck in knowing the answer. Sometimes knowing a question is the most important thing. Knowing that the question is, I learned this as a rabbi. When you become a rabbi, if you think that you're going to go out into the world and know all the answers, you're in big trouble. But if you feel like you've got a grasp on what the questions are, that's okay. Because I don't need to know the answer whether the piece of meat is kosher, because I can always find someone to ask. I just want to know that there's a question, right? So it's the same thing. There are actually different titles. There's a code in the Talmud to recognize whether somebody comes from the period of the Mishnah or the period of the Gemara, right? A title Rebbe almost always refers to somebody from the period of the Mishnah. The title Rav always refers to somebody from the period of the Gemara. Okay, by the way, this has nothing to do with Rabbi Aaron or Binny. That was just something students kind of think. I haven't figured that out yet, but whatever, right? Nothing to do with that. But in any event, somebody once asked me that, like, so, are you a later rabbi? No, right? But, so there are different types. But let's not get into a historical discussion because I really want to get into tefillah. So, take the text, pick at least one partner, or work in a larger group. My advice to you, by the way, is to try to find someone you don't know to do this with, because if you're doing this with someone you know so well, so make a larger group if you want, 2, 4 people, whatever, so you also get to know somebody. But that's your choice, okay? Okay. So let me hear what you got. Let's first look at the first story. Maybe just to repeat the story so everybody's on the same page, right? I'm Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says, "B'sha'a sh'ala Moshe l'marom," when Moshe went up to the heavens, okay? He found God, the Holy One, blessed be He, putting ktarim, crowns, what we call tagin, on the letters. If you look in an actual Torah scroll, Sefer Torah, you'll find that the calligraphy that is done by a sofer, by a scribe, has certain, they're called tagin, they look like little crowns, and they're actually, I think, seven letters that have tagin on them, right? Or maybe more, nine. Shatnez, Shin Ein Tet Nun Zayin, you know, there are five of them, and two more, right? And they basically have three crowns that kind of look like a shin almost, right? One to the right, one to the left, and one up. And they're like the minutiae of the letters that themselves are the details of the words that are just the details of, like, you know, we don't even, thanks, right? So you have like a let's say this is, for example, I don't know, shin, right? There are different ways to do a shin. We'll do one like this, right? So you'll have like...
only on certain letters,
right? Right. So there's one up to the right, one up to the middle, one up to the left, right? There are different customs to do this. You gotta get a sofer who does this, right? You have discovered artistically why I am not a scribe. But in any event, like, you know, if you have a shin, a letter, what's a letter in a word? We don't take a letter seriously in words. It's just a letter. It's like one little piece. These aren't even the letters. These are the tagin, the little crown, the little tips, the commas, right, on the letters. So he finds God sitting up in heaven, right, tying crowns on the letters. Amar lo Moshe. Amar lo. So God says to him, Moshe, ain shalom b'yirecha. No. They don't say hello, where you come from? Las tutzich, right? So God says to him, what does a servant say hello to his master? I should walk in and have the audacity to say hello? Right? Right. Moshe comes in and says, you know, like if Moshe would have come up there and say, hey God, what's going on? That would have been a little chutzpah dick, right? You should have given me a hand. You see, I'm working hard here. You're just standing there like a goomf, right? Don't look goomf up in the dictionary. It's my own personal word, right? Miyad amalo. So immediately Moshe realizes he's missing the boat here. So he quotes a pasuk, quotes a verse. Ve'ata yigdal na koach Hashem kasher dibata. And now, let the strength of God become great as you have spoken, which is something that Moshe himself says in the Torah. Right? That's the story. Okay. So first of all, questions. Yes.
What do these crowns mean?
Right. Okay. So you think like, you know, God could be pretty busy. He's got a lot to do, you know, big world. Moshe comes up, and he finds God. You know, imagine, you know, they used to have a TV show, What's My Line, I think it was called, or Match PM, whatever it was. You fill in the line, right? Fill in the blank, right? And you find God. So there'd be three contestants. One would say, you know, I don't know, creating matches, shidduchim. That I would understand. That's hard work. And there's a Gemara that says that's what God does. Okay, I understand that. Finds God, I don't know. Well, we know he doesn't find God running the Knesset, right? That we know. God definitely isn't doing that. Tying crowns on letters. What is that? Yeah, what else? Questions?
So a man can't even see Hashem except his back, you know.
Okay, yeah. What about, like, Moshe sees God? Well, what is that about? So again, this is an Agadah. That's why I gave you the introduction. You're absolutely right. The Agadah chooses a certain paradigm, a certain allegory. How does the allegory of seeing God make sense? Yes, David.
What's the whole you should have assisted me? Since when does God need help?
Yeah, what is that about? You know, at some point at Israelite, someone will say, usually Rabbi Aaron, you know, that very often we have a first grade perception of God. And, you know, you still find people who think that God is this old man with a long white beard in heaven. Ha, ha, ha. And now when he says that, you'll say, Rabbi, Talmud. I mean, it's a crazy allegory. Why is Moshe helping God? Why is God annoyed that Moshe isn't helping God? And he realized, of course, that this speaks to a much deeper question. Am I needed in this world? Why does God need me? I mean, that's the question. Does it really make a difference? Does this ring familiar yet from the questions we were asking before? What else? Questions? Yes. Oh, we want to understand Moshe's response. Why doesn't Moshe respond with, you know, I didn't feel it appropriate, or sorry? Why does he say, okay, so may your strength become great. So it is written, so it shall be done. Well, what is that? Right? Any other questions? Yes.
When Hashem is not in your
right. What is the allegory? of the image of God sitting doing anything. Okay? Any other questions? Yes?
What's with the tying of the crown?
Right. Somebody else mentioned that. Why are we tying? You would think that you would be writing the crowns on the letters. Or imprinting. What does it mean to tie them on? Okay? Yes? What is the significance of letters in general? Okay, so let's take a journey into this. Yes? Ooh, okay. The second question you ask, which is why is this an attractive Shabbat, is actually one of those projects that I've been wanting to do for a long time and have not gotten to, which is that people very often study this stuff. Never mind why it's an attractive Shabbat, why does it follow this particular... Trying to fathom why different pieces fit into different places is an incredible journey. And I did this once with Tractate Brachot, and it took me a long time. It's an amazing thing. So it's an excellent question, but we definitely won't get to it. But there is a reason. And understanding what Shabbat is about, and we may actually figure that out. You may have an answer to your question by the time we finish here. The first question, which relates specifically to the story, so why does God need a greeting? I mean, if the point is that God is saying, Hayalach Allah Azraini, you should have helped me, why doesn't God just say, what are you standing there for? Come give me a hand. He doesn't say that. He said, well, you don't say hello. And then, when Moshe says, well, I didn't know I'm supposed to say hello, so God doesn't answer that. Did you notice that? God doesn't say, yes, you should. Right? Right. It's like you find yourself as a parent sometimes, getting into this recipe that you swore you'd never get into. Right? You know, like, you know, kid comes in, right? And they walk in the house, and sometimes they have their thing, right? You know, they go to the kitchen, they go to the fridge. You know, one of my children, I can usually spot them. They have this very unique bend, and it's usually the rest of their body's hidden in the fridge, right? Come down, say hello, say good morning, right? So then they say, oh, sorry, good morning. Well, of course, by that point, good morning doesn't mean anything, because, so you don't want that good morning. Or like when you tell your kids to say I'm sorry, I'm sorry. No, don't say I'm sorry like that. Say I'm sorry like you mean it. But I don't mean it. Right? How do you get it? So God does this with Moshe. You should say hello. So Moshe says, oh, I didn't know I'm supposed to say hello. So God just moves on. Well, what is that? You should help me. Right. So then just ask him to help. And by the way, one more thing, since we're on this topic, right? If God seems to be asking for a greeting, right? Because Moshe's answer is, does a servant say hello to his master, right? So there are two things that are interesting here. One is, if God wanted a greeting, right, he should have said, Hayalacha livarcheni. You should have blessed me. That's how the term for greeting, right? Okay? Right? Barcheni ana. You know, you meet people and you bless them. That's usually in the Talmud, in literature, what happens when you meet people. You bless them. And we're going to get to that. Tomorrow we're having a class about blessings, so we're not getting to that now. Okay, so let's take a journey into this. What exactly is going on here? When is this occurring? There are lots of instances where Moshe talks to God. Which Moshe talking to God are we talking about? So, we have a clue, because it says, Kishem Moshe Allah Lamarom, when Moshe went up to the high place, which I'm going to use a euphemism of heaven, but of course that's a ridiculous term, but just... because it's easy for us, okay? When Moshe went up to heaven, when does Moshe go up to heaven? It doesn't say Moshe went up to Sinai. It says, Kshalal Maram, when he went up to the high place. Which is a direct reference to the fact that physically Moshe may have gone up Sinai, but we don't really know where Moshe was. Right? So Moshe goes upstairs. We'll call it the upstairs. So which Moshe going upstairs are we talking about? There are really only two possibilities. Three, which are really two. There are only two instances where Moshe goes up. And has this whole conversation with God, for the most part, the famous ones. And they are getting the Torah, which he really does twice. He gets the first tablet, then he goes back up and he helps write the second tablet. So, getting the Torah, right?
Did he go up outside?
Not before, but in the middle, after. Okay? In fact, we're in that period now. Right? These are the 40 days following Shavuot, following the receiving of Torah at Sinai. Moshe's up there getting the Torah. He comes down on the 17th day of Tammuz. Things go way off. Sin of the golden calf, one of the worst mistakes we ever made, whatever that means, we're going to get to that in a second, breaks the tablets, now he's got a mess, because they're at Sinai, they were supposed to have the Torah, they broke the tablets, he goes up again for another 40 days, but he doesn't go up to get anything, He goes up to do what? He doesn't have to do tshuva. He has to get tshuva. He has to get forgiveness. He has to fix things. So he goes up to get things fixed. Comes back down, basically to tell the people, it's fixed. So now, he's somehow cleaned up the mess, whatever that means, but they're back where they started, they got no Torah. So he has to go up a third time, and he comes down 40 days later, after the 17th of Tammuz, add a couple of days for the up and down, so now you're on, right, he comes back down, he goes back up on the new moon of Elul, the month of Elul, and comes back 40 days later, which is Yom Kippur, 10th of Tishrei. Up and down, up and down. I'm not going to go into why he has to go up and down. Why doesn't he just say, okay, you're forgiven? You know, like that would be smart, but, you know, maybe he has to get a hamburger. I don't know, whatever it is, right? Goes up and down. So there's three up and downs. It seems, and I wish we had the time to demonstrate why this is so, but it seems that we're talking about the middle time. Let's just assume that to be the case.